Welcome to the Smosh View podcast. I'm your host, Sean Hurst, and today we'll be discussing the role of compliance technology in the realm of ESG. As companies face increasing regulatory oversight and investor scrutiny, accurately reflecting their rhetoric on ESG has become more critical than ever before. In this episode, we explore the compliance technology and how it can help organizations mitigate the material, financial, and reputational risks associated with ESG. Today, I'm joined by Georgia Stewart, co-founder and CEO of Tumelo. Welcome, Georgia.
Thank you for having me, Sean.
So my first question is, what originally got you interested in ESG and how did that lead to where you are today with Tumelo? And maybe give us a bit of a background on what Tumelo actually does.
Okay, so what initially got me interested in ESG was specifically my university studies into conservation and climate change. So I was studying natural sciences at Cambridge and kind of the natural world and biodiversity and climate change were big parts of that work. And I started to get interested in ESG specifically as it relates to finance when I joined a group called Positive Investment Cambridge, who were working on the sustainable investment of Cambridge's endowment fund. So Cambridge has £6 billion invested into the markets, some of it private, but much of it into public markets, invested through various fund managers, usually based in London, who maintain and grow the wealth of the university. And we were interested in where that money was being invested and whether the way it was being invested aligned with the mission statement of the university, which was about kind of furthering human flourishing and solving health crises and solving the climate crises, et cetera. So we started looking into that and kind of created working groups and ran campaigns around the issue of university endowments being aligned with the university missions generally, like globally, not just at Cambridge. And then I guess I went down a track with some others there looking at shareholder voting specifically and how as a fund manager, when you are managing money on behalf of a client like Cambridge University, asset allocation, like where you put the money, like which companies you buy with the money, is one part of investing. But a really, really important part, which has been, I would say, massively overlooked, is how you then steward those companies responsibly. So how do you manage them as a shareholder? And that's something that the university had very little control over and which most clients have very little control over. But actually, I would argue, has significant impact. And that really got us into the world of, you know, what does a responsible shareholder look like? How can we reach ESG outcomes or improve ESG outcomes through dialogue with companies and voting at companies? And that's really what got me interested in ESG as it relates to finance.
And that directly led you to Tumelo, to founding Tumelo.
Yeah, it did. So what we realized when we were at university was that it was very, very difficult as a client of a fund manager to be able to have influence on stewardship. So it's easier to have influence on the asset allocation part, deciding which companies you buy, because you go to effectively kind of a fund supermarket and you can buy any kind of fund with any kind of different combination of companies in it. What's then hard is making sure that those companies are managed in the way that you would expect, you know, that the votes on climate disclosure go the way that you want them to, or that your voice is represented in that way. And so we created a platform which helped the fund managers who were managing money for the clients to be able to collect client opinion or give clients the right to vote entirely so that the clients could have much more influence over some of the ESG issues that were coming up at the companies that ultimately their capital was invested in. And these are issues like workers' rights at Amazon or kind of climate change issues at the big fossil fuel companies. So really, really critical issues that affect shareholder outcomes, obviously, because they affect company performance, but also which affect kind of the communities around that company, the workers within that company, the supply chain, kind of environment, all the externalities that we didn't used to think about that now know are really important.
So this was a few years ago that you were talking about this and you were very passionate about this. And it seems like you're way ahead of the game. If we look
it's
at... Well, it's great to see that the regulators, like the FCA, are starting to take this really seriously. I mean, I think they have taken it seriously for a while, but they're making a concerted effort now around this, putting some guidance in place. They recently did a survey with some of the financial institutions to figure out how to go about talking around things like greenwashing, you know, provide transparency around ESG and that sort of thing. So I guess my next question is, what in your opinion and what you're seeing, the people that you're speaking to, what is the current picture around ESG compliance?
Yeah, so I guess something that fund managers and financial institutions are thinking about a lot is what you mentioned there, which is the fund labeling regimes. So we already have something called SFDR in the EU, and then the FCA are working on their own version of that, which is the SDR, Sustainability Disclosure. And that will allow, that will define what the funds are able to call themselves. So I think for institutional investors, for clients like Cambridge University or the big pension funds, this is perhaps less important because they are ultimately going to go and talk to a consultant or some kind of advisory body, which will help them choose a fund and will go beyond the kind of label that's on the front page of the fund document and understand what's in that fund and what is that fund trying to achieve and are the companies sustainable or not, and you know, how much pressure is the fund manager putting on those companies from an ESG perspective. But for consumers, like for your retail investors, this is really important because they are not going to advisors most of the time. And they are choosing a fund literally from a kind of fund supermarket, from a list. And if a fund has impact in its title, then as a retail investor, well, you would expect that that fund has impact. Or if it has ESG in its title, you'd expect that it's focused on ESG or climate, etc. And what this regulation is bringing in is some standardization around what is allowed to be called impact and what is allowed to be kind of mentioned climate change and what's not. And that's going to have a massive impact probably on fund flows. So if you are called impact and people are looking for impact, then, you know, your fund's going to show up. And if people are looking for climate and you're able to call yourself climate, you know, likewise, you benefit from that. And the funds that are not able to say those things will not be able to say those things and won't fall into buckets that they might have over the last couple of years by labeling themselves something different. So I think SDR aligns really well with consumer duty, which is something that will affect kind of a wider number of financial institutions beyond just asset managers. And it's all about kind of protecting that retail customer and making sure that the retail customer really understands the product that they're getting and is being communicated to fairly by the institutions who obviously have a kind of great power and knowledge asymmetry.
And it is great to see. I think there has been a little bit of a case of the Wild West for a little while now, where firms have been able to bend the rules maybe a little bit around how they're advertising their funds, their investments, their product. And it's good to see that the regulators are taking this seriously. Now, you've mentioned Europe and the UK in terms of some regulations that are coming into place. But have you seen this elsewhere in the world? It seems like in some aspects, like data privacy and other areas like that, America kind of follows behind a little bit. Are you seeing some noise being made in other regions?
Yeah, so the SEC in the US is proposing enhanced disclosures and to be able to categorize certain types of ESG strategies. So I would be unsurprised if that kind of comes into play. They have been, can I use the words, kind of going after large asset managers who have been, I guess, wrongly labeling their funds climate or ESG orientated, and then advertising them to mostly retail investors and advisors who, as I said, don't have that greater level of support in the fund selection process. So I wouldn't be surprised if this type of labeling gets rolled out much more widely. And it does obviously make sense, you know, that in a supermarket, you couldn't call your can of beans low sugar if they weren't, in fact, low sugar. Whereas in the fund labeling world, that has really been the case. You can call your fund anything, and there wasn't really a labeling standard. And then the challenge, I think, which we have globally, which the US faces the same as the EU, the same as the UK, is that in order to label a fund correctly, the fund manager needs to know a lot about the constituent companies that make up that fund, whether they're private or public, that data is not always available. Now, there is some data available, but it's often also not standardized. So you've got various initiatives globally that are trying to force companies to standardize the ESG data that they produce about themselves so that others can work out whether they want to invest in them or not, and then based on whether they do or don't invest in them, what they should label their fund. So there's multiple layers of kind of regulation that needs to occur. So the SEC has proposed that climate disclosure and regulation that where companies will have to start reporting on that type of thing at the company level. And that's obviously kind of a prerequisite for a fund being able to report on that at the fund level.
Well, that kind of answers my next question that I had, which is, you know, we've talked about financial services and how this has impacted them, but there is also the downstream, you know, there's other companies, other industries that are getting affected by this or that should be taking ESG quite seriously. And I was going to ask how these challenges vary across those different industries, but I think you kind of answered it there. I don't know if you wanted to add anything else, but, you know, from my perspective, from what I heard, there is these companies that maybe are part of a fund, maybe part of an investment portfolio, need to be able to disclose in a consistent manner, right? Something that's measurable and comparable to other industries. And, you know, obviously I work mainly with financial services institutions and financial services regulators. But are you seeing other regulators from other industries also paying attention to this and, you know, following suit from, you know, people like the FCA and the SEC?
Yeah, well, I guess you have, for example, TCFD, which is the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, which affects companies far beyond the financial industry. That's being chaired by the Michael Bloomberg, the founder of Bloomberg. And that is really so that it's a disclosure by everyone for the financial industry so that the financial market can properly do risk assessment, can make better informed decisions about capital allocation, can do better strategic planning and about their exposure to climate-related risks over the short, medium and long term, and kind of understand the effects that those risks will have on the company and its suppliers and its competitors. And I guess what the task force in this instance is saying is that, you know, they recognize that markets are an efficient mechanism to drive, to kind of take account of those risks and potentially drive towards outcomes, but they cannot do that without better data. And I think the other thing that we'll see beyond climate is data on kind of social or human rights related risks. And there are various organizations working on that as well. So it has to all happen well, together or in sequence, because you cannot have financial organizations being forced to disclose if they do not have the data from the underlying constituent companies.
You touched on the social aspect. So ESG is obviously three components: environmental, social, and governance. Now, we've focused quite a bit on the environmental side because that is one of the more obvious ones. We see it in the press almost daily, and it's something we should all be concerned about or aware of at the very least. But the social side of it, the S in ESG, is something that we at Smarsh take, you know, quite seriously. It's something that we want to help our customers with. And that could be a little bit different from what we've been talking about. You know, how does the human data compare to the environmental data? You know, the social aspects, the flip side of this, maybe it's internal social awareness, maybe it's concepts like bullying or intimidation internally, the reputation of the company based on these sort of things. Is this something that you touch on much or that you have some awareness of?
Yeah, I would say that, so we come from a world where we think about shareholders first. And we are thinking about what do shareholders want from companies and what pressures should they put on companies and how should they steward companies to do better. And shareholders care massively, not just about environmental issues, but about the other ESG issues. So S and G are really important. Governance has always been the focus, and I guess is kind of the holistic sense, you are governing a company, and that should include environmental and social issues as well. But governance, which would traditionally be things like who are the directors and how are the executives remunerated, and, you know, how is the auditor performing are the typical issues that shareholders were historically very interested in and you know, are still today. You then also have social issues, which might look at things like workers' rights, hourly worker representation on boards. Obviously, you've got gender equality and kind of and gender inequality and pay gap issues. And then you also have things like workers' racial equity issues within especially large kind of multinational organizations. Like that type of thing has come up at Starbucks and at Apple and at other big household names, where shareholders are asking those companies to do better reporting so that they themselves can assess the risk that those social issues are potentially presenting to the companies, to their competitors, to the suppliers. So I would say the data around social issues is not as strong. There is nothing as kind of sophisticated as the Task Force for Climate-Related Disclosures in the social space as there is in the climate space, but there's a lot of discussion about it. And the UK Department for Work and Pensions, like that ministry here, is very focused on social issues, not least because obviously pensions, which are invested on behalf of workers in the UK and invested in order to improve outcomes for workers in the UK, should really be looking at social issues because they are the issues that matter to those people who are the shareholders. So climate is obviously important and presents a material financial risk that we all know about, but social issues present a similar financial risk and is, I guess, are equally important to the individuals whose capital is ultimately being invested in those companies at the end of the day.
Yeah, you know, it's something we're seeing quite a lot because obviously we're a communications company. We deal with capture of communications, storage of communication, especially from a compliance perspective, storing it in a compliant manner. And also, most importantly, is being able to monitor those communications for, you know, traditionally it's been around compliance risks. It could be rogue traders. It could be many different aspects. But what we're finding is a lot of our customers are very interested in that social aspect. They are monitoring for things. It's been quite a while before ESG was the word for this, but for quite a while they've been monitoring for things like internal bullying, making sure that the culture of the company is being looked after, that people are being treated fairly internally as well. Because I think a lot of companies realize that people aren't making decisions about where to work just based on a salary or, you know, the direct benefits. They're also looking at the culture of the company. And if, for example, a bank X, something comes out in the press saying that there's a toxic work culture and some emails get leaked about this and nothing's been done about it, that's not going to bode well for them. And, you know, given equal benefits, equal salary, an individual is going to look at that company and say, I'll rather go to a company Y because they seem to have a better culture. Now, that makes obvious sense, but I think it's driving a lot more, especially the younger generation. They're making their decisions based on more than just that financial aspect. And if you want the best employees, you need to have the best work culture. You need to be taking care of that S aspect of the ESG. From your perspective, and this is more an opinion, I know that Tamello, it's not necessarily something you're focused on, but you're obviously in this industry, so you've seen what goes on. But you know, how do you think companies could better monitor or affect change around that social side of things?
I mean that these issues are really, really important, and retention and acquisition of talent is a key issue that shareholders should be concerned about. And I just, before I answer that question directly, I wanted to kind of share that while issues like gender diversity or racial equity might seem obvious issues that when shareholders raise them, companies respond, that's really not the case. It is in fact the case that most shareholders, who aren't usually the large fund managers globally, do not vote through shareholder proposals that demand kind of racial equity audits or gender diversity audits. It isn't the common stance that shareholders put that pressure on companies. I would say kind of 70% of the time, those resolutions are failing at the company and annual general meeting. So I just want to make the point that it's actually very rare that these things are forced through by shareholders, although it is becoming more common. And just something that came to mind when you were talking about kind of retention and how to attract employees in the first place, you know, shareholders are really concerned about that issue. And I just looked up, for example, one of the proposals that will go publicly to the AGM of Bank of America this year, for example, is a shareholder proposal that reports, that asks Bank of America to report to shareholders on the effectiveness of their diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. So talking about some of the things you were mentioning, the report should be done at reasonable expense, include proprietary information, but provide transparency on outcomes using quantitative metrics for hiring, retention, promotion of employees, including data by gender, race, and ethnicity. So these types of issues that you were talking about are exactly what shareholders are asking for. And in some instances getting, but not across the board. And it's information that they really, really want in order to make decisions about whether to support and invest in or kind of buy debt from a company. The question you asked me about social, you know, about companies having good social, like a good culture, for example, is something that active managers who are investing in companies would pay a lot of attention to. So, and similarly, actually, like the sell side equity research analysts who are writing research about companies will often go and speak to ex-employees and will try and understand the kind of communication mechanisms that exist within the company and how people feel about those before actually making an investment. So you don't see that in the passive fund managers because they're tracking an index, and so they're kind of all the companies are going to be lumped in there depending on probably market cap, for example. But in the active management space, those things are really paid attention to, and I would say there's increasing focus on them, especially when people think about the new workforce that's coming through and the kind of expectations of those younger people around, you know, whether it's work-life balance or whether it's equality issues or kind of just well-being and mental health and the kind of level of communication and gratification that they are expecting from their workplace.
Yeah, and that's quite interesting. So obviously from our perspective, we have a tool, a software solution that allows compliance officers to go and monitor specifically regulated individuals, right? Because that's a mandate that's required from the regulators. Now, that in itself is tough because there's a lot of communication that goes out, right? And anything that could potentially lead to a trade has to be tracked, monitored, and compliance officers have to get eyes on these sort of communications. Now, add into that, you know, a company-wide monitoring of these sort of challenges around the social aspects. And it seems like it's a task that is way beyond what they're capable of with their current workforce. And that's the conversation we're having with a lot of companies. Like you say, the attitude towards this is we need to be doing something around this. We have a lot of people, investors that are interested in this. We have internal stakeholders that are interested in this information, but we just do not have the capacity to monitor and track all this information. We're barely hanging on with what we have to do anyway today. And, you know, that's something we're working hard on as a company. We're utilizing things like, you know, cloud technology, scalability, and, you know, obviously the AI, the new buzzword for 2023, the AI machine learning to help people to surface these sort of things in a somewhat automated manner. And I think we're going to see more of that. We definitely have a lot of companies interested in this technology and how it can help them without them having to invest too much more on, you know, in the time that the compliance officers have to spend on it. So it's definitely a challenge for us to try and work out and have those conversations really with our potential clients or our existing clients to see how we can help them with, you know, without increasing their workload. You know, I was wondering from your perspective, what do you think's next? What do you think's coming, you know, big things coming this year? Obviously we have some regulations, we're going to have some announcements from the FCA, I'm sure, through 2023, giving some more guidance around ESG. They've got a thing up on their website right now with their core themes around transparency, trust, the tools that people should be using, transition, and team. So those are the five core themes. But from your perspective, is there anything big that you think is coming down the line that people should be aware of?
Well, aside from the fund labelling and the kind of ESG stuff that's happening at a company level and obviously consumer duty, I mean, there's going to be a continuation of those things. So there's something called Consumer Champion, for example, coming down the pipe. There is going to be a proliferation in the number and type and kind of controversy of the issues, controversy level of the issues that companies have to now deal with and answer to their shareholders about, including some of the things you talked about, like harassment and bullying in the workplace, going to become important. And we'll see resolutions about that, which really means that kind of that's transcending internal company dynamics and becoming something that will exist in its own right in the media and among the minds of shareholders. There's some interesting developments in the US, for example. Something called the Index Act exists in North America at the moment. It was put forward by Dan Sullivan, who is an Alaskan senator, and he is demanding that the large asset managers democratize the right to vote from the asset managers to their underlying investors, both institutional and retail. And what that would mean for companies is that they would have a much larger audience to answer to when it comes to their shareholders. And interestingly, that their shareholders would start to overlap in a major way with other types of stakeholders. So if you can imagine today, for example, the largest shareholders of your average S&P 500 company will be the big passive fund managers like BlackRock and State Street and Vanguard. And then a kind of list of other fund managers before you start hitting kind of big institutional investors like sovereign wealth funds. If the voting power of those large fund managers is democratized, while they might still appear high up on the cap table, the ability to decide who the directors of those businesses are and how their CEO is remunerated and which resolutions pass or not will not sit with those fund managers, but will in fact be the underlying retail investors and institutions, who will more likely be run by people who are consumers and employees and kind of in the community or part of the supply chain. So you start to tend towards that kind of model that people like talking about, the stakeholder capitalism idea, where you cannot just run your company in order to serve shareholders, because actually all these other stakeholders are incredibly important and ultimately end up being kind of one and the same thing when you get down to the underlying kind of source of capital, which is the average pension member. And so that is going to be an interesting development. And what it will mean for companies is that they need to find a new way to communicate with shareholders and consumers and with internal employees. And whether that's kind of internal communication methods, which probably do need to improve, as well as thinking about how their IR, the investor relations department, evolves, is also going to be really important. So it's a very interesting space. And I think that ties into all of these other things we're talking about around better transparency and greater accountability. And on the whole, all of this is only going to increase.
And only going to benefit the end consumer, right? Yeah. Ultimately. And that's great to see. It's just more transparency around that. It seems like finance has typically been a black box affair a lot of the times, right? Something that people don't really have too much insight into what goes on, but it seems like that is changing and has been changing for quite a few years now.
Yeah, and just general that tend towards transparency, accountability, and democratization. And there is something in the US, for example, that listeners might be interested in looking at, and which I can't go into too much detail on, but it's the universal proxy card, for example, is going to make it so much easier for individuals, almost employees, to be able to put forward proposals for their own directors to be on company boards, for example. And, you know, making that process has previously been very difficult to change a director on a company board. And the fact that the SEC is looking to make that easier is really important. It obviously means the directors will be held to a greater level of scrutiny, and it democratizes that process for employees or for other people who have ideas about how companies might be run better. So I think it drives towards, as you're saying, greater accountability and greater transparency, and ultimately it's good for the employee, it's good for the small shareholder at the end of the line.
I'm sure there's more than a few nervous directors out there, but it is ultimately it's a good thing. There needs to be accountability for some of the stuff that goes on. So I wanted to finish this off with a bit of your personal opinion. You're a CEO of a company, and a big topic of conversation, I think everyone's getting pretty bored of it, is the hybrid working. You know, we've all gone back to work from, you know, lockdown. I mean, that's been quite a while now. But there's been a real shift in the change of work culture. So that, I think, also plays into the social aspect, right? The cultural representation of a company. From your perspective, how do you see that going? Do you, you know, a lot of companies are saying, hey, we want everyone back in the office. How are you seeing that work? How are you navigating that?
Gosh, I feel like I could answer that with like a half an hour. Okay, there's some context required, which is that we are a COVID baby. We went into lockdown with about 8 people on our team and came out of it with 30. So many, many people on the team don't know another way of working because this was their first role. And then the people who do know another way of working from previous roles don't really know another way of working at Tomello. So I think the standard for us is remote first. That said, we have a very busy office in London. We have a busy office in Bristol where lots of the team will come in, but it's very, very flexible. And we will maintain that standard. I think we did a really interesting survey with the team at the end of last year where we're about 50 people now, where we asked everyone whether they thought they did their most, that, what did I ask? I think the question I asked was, do you believe some types of work are better done in person? And something like 75% of people in the company said, yes, some types of work like collaborative working are better done in person. And then I said, how often do you believe you do that better in person work in person? And then only kind of 25% of people said that they always do work in person when they know it could be better done in person, which for me was, that's the flag. That's the worry. That's the piece where I'm thinking, gosh, how can I change that? I don't mind if people are doing work that's worthwhile doing at home, but I really want people to proactively make the decision to come in and be with their peers when they know that it would be better for them and the company if they did so, when they know they would be faster or decisions would be better. So we were trying to tackle that specific problem, and we looked at doing things, and we have implemented things like paying for travel on days where people want to work together in person specifically, as opposed to just, you know, come in for anything, any old kind of meeting, making sure that people are able to book nice spaces, go for lunches with their team. So kind of encouraging that very specific behavior change is something that we've been doing over the last 3 months and seen positive effect from. It's taken the leaders of those teams to also step up, you know, for us to push them to say, you know, we need you to recognize when it will be better for your teams to be in person, talk to them about that, and be the kind of pinnacle around which others can corral and come together on a specific day, for example. So I think for us, we are generally are quite a young company. People's standards have been set by their experience in COVID, and we will remain very flexible. We also, therefore, coming back to your point on kind of tools, we have really good tools internally, which allow
us. I was going to say, it's amazing the technology we have today. You know, imagine COVID happened 10 years ago. You know, would we be able to have been as productive as we have been for the last 2 years if we didn't have tools like Zoom or Microsoft Teams?
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, we use Slack, and it's just, for us, it really makes it so easy for us to be anywhere. I mean, I still sit in the office with people and I still use Slack with them.
Yeah. it's amazing. It's blown my mind. Obviously, I've been in the tech industry now for 25 years, and the changes I've seen over time around how people communicate and the abilities that we have, it's pretty crazy. And the one thing that I've seen happen when we're speaking a lot to our customers and potential customers in the financial services area, a lot of them are concerned about some of the big fines that have come out with, you know, I'm sure you've seen in the press around WhatsApp usage when they shouldn't have been because they weren't monitoring those communications. So some massive fines there. And that's kind of sparked the shift that people are trying to make, you know, to get people into the office more often because it's easier to monitor what's going on and, you know, make sure that people are doing the right thing in terms of how they're communicating with other individuals and also internally. And we're seeing that shift. We're also seeing the shift of, you know, for people, it seemed like 5 or so years ago, there was a big change over to bring your own devices, right? So no longer corporate owned smartphones, for example, right? So back then, everyone had an iPhone that the company provided, and it got quite expensive. So they shifted over to saying, oh, well, buy your own phone, we'll pay towards it, but then it's your phone and you do what you want with it. But that's now shifting back because of these concerns around being able to monitor these communications. I'm guessing with your company, that's not something you really have to think about too much, because you're not regulated in that way where you have to monitor those sort of communications. But I'm sure there's still that concern, right? It's the way that people communicate when they're at home is going to be a little different to the way they communicate when they're sitting in a professional office space, right?
Yeah, and we do still, you know, we still have to think about how people communicate, where they communicate, you know, what tools they do that through, and you know, we want to maintain a good culture, but also we have regulated clients, and therefore ourselves need to maintain a certain standard, certainly around security, and I guess that encompasses communications and the tools we use to communicate and kind of the authentication methods that we use. So yeah, as you kind of pointed out, people buy their own phones, but then we put them through a really rigorous process where they basically can't do anything with them. So I think it matters even for a company of our size, certainly if you're in finance, you know, the credibility that you need to be able to have, and you know, if you were to be audited, for example, we would want to be able to kind of stand up our own 2 feet in the same way that a financially regulated company could.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think from my takeaways from this conversation is there definitely is a proper focus now on ESG, which is fantastic to see, and it can only really benefit the end consumer. And I think financial services, the FSIs are taking this seriously, but maybe they need to have another renewed focus on it, because the regulators certainly are having a renewed focus on it. There's a lot of initiatives out there, and there's a few that you mentioned that I didn't know about, so I'll be definitely doing a bit of research on that. So thank you for that. And it's just, yeah, anybody listening to this podcast, if you haven't been aware of ESG, or if it's kind of been on your periphery, maybe have a bit of a renewed focus and spend some time looking into it, because it is important. It's important for our future in general, but also for your organizations. I think you definitely need to be taking this seriously. So are there any last words from yourself that you want to leave us with?
Well, I agree. And I think if you are on the front foot on ESG in your organization, then it's a really positive opportunity for you. And with kind of cloud technology and the ability to gather and aggregate and analyze data becoming so much easier, you can you know, use that as an opportunity to improve the whole organization, the way it operates and the way it communicates with external stakeholders, including shareholders. So yeah, I think it's a great opportunity, even though there might be some upfront kind of learning required.
That's actually a great word to finish this off on, is it is an opportunity. Regulations tend to be seen as a tax, right, on these companies. But, you know, I think if this is approached in the right way, it's a real opportunity for companies. Thank you so much, Georgia. This conversation has been enlightening and fascinating. It's been great chatting with you, and I really appreciate it. And for everyone listening, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you again on the next podcast.
Thank you, Sean and Smash.